Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to the Couple Speak Relationship Forum on Blog Talk Radio. I'm your host, Susan Lager, a psychotherapist and relationship coach at my private practice, the Couple Center in Portsmouth, New Hampshire, where I broadcast live each month on Wednesdays, usually at 8:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Today's 45-minute March 15th episode, titled Build a Problem-Solving Mindset with 7 Critical Tools, it's in the middle of the afternoon because I have a very special guest from Ireland, Cardage Buckley, who's on a different time zone. So I thought I'd make it a little bit easier for him so he wasn't doing a show with me in the middle of the night. Cardage is an experienced and enthusiastic learning and development professional with extensive coaching, mentoring, and motivational skills and a proven ability to empower others, enabling them to achieve their full potential. With a Master's of Education in the Psychology of Education from the University of Bristol, he has worked in training and development and coaching in numerous countries, including Ireland, Australia, New Zealand, and the UK. You can contact Cardage on his website at coachingpositiveperformance.com. Now, one technical issue. If you're calling into the show live, you can join us with a question or a comment by dialing 1 on your phone, and you'll be next in line to come on the air. And as always, I welcome comments and questions. It makes it a conversation and it's more interesting. So please don't be shy. Just dial 1. Hi, Cardage. Welcome to my show.
Hi. How are you, Susan? It's great to be here.
I'm fine. Hopefully you're having better weather than we are here in the Northeast. We've had a massive snowstorm with power outages and quite the mess, but it should be calmer where you are, hopefully.
Well, we here in Ireland, we don't get the really bad weather, but we don't get the really good weather. So we win sometimes and we lose other times.
I know. I've been there and I loved Ireland. A very sultry weather. In any event, you know, it was very hard for me, Cardage, to pick a topic with you because I found you on Twitter and then I went to your website and I started reading some of your blog posts, and there were so many choices of things to discuss with you. You deal with time management, confidence, communication, motivation, negative beliefs, stress management, and so much more. So this was very hard to narrow it down to a problem-solving mindset, I want you to know.
Well, that's good. I know I take a multimodal approach to stress and performance management is the way I like to explain it. So I do try and come at it from every aspect. It also adds a bit of variety for the reader of the blog, so they're not getting hit with the same topic every time.
Yeah. Well, it's good that you deal with all the critical aspects that would go into dealing with issues, dealing with problems. Now, I'm wondering, to begin with, how would you say a problem-solving mindset is important in a person's life? In other words, what is the likely impact of developing this mindset?
Well, it's easy to think. I mean, a lot of personal development experts and a lot of people who at least profess to go into caring professions, they maybe aren't really in caring professions, but they like to make us think that, you know, we set ourselves a target or a goal, and it's just a smooth path. We take action every day, and we're going to get there. But any goal of value takes time, and where time is involved, you will always hit some problems somewhere, because you can't control other people. You can't control the world around you. You can't control, as obvious as it sounds, factors which are just outside your control. And if something else goes wrong, it can have a knock-on effect on you, and you have to deal with it. So if you're not prepared to be open-minded and positive about taking on challenges and problems as they come, you're really going to get stuck in a rut, and you're not going to make a lot of progress. I mean, if you think back of, as Einstein's reputed to say, and I probably won't quote it word for word, so I'll paraphrase it, you won't solve a problem with the same mindset that creates it. So it isn't, the solving the problem requires us, first of all, we have to have a mindset to take take on the challenge of solving the problem, but the solving the problem in itself will change our mindset, and that helps us to grow and to move forward.
It's very well said. I have a friend and colleague who I think was guilty of not having a problem-solving mindset. And what I noticed and I shared with her at one point was that she was chronically coping, and she was doing an adequate job of coping using the same old skill sets and not looking at it from a different point of view. But she was never really solving the problem. And I like one of the things that you said was that when you have a problem-solving mindset, you understand the actual difference between solving the problem and merely changing the nature of it.
Yeah, I mean, it's first of all, you have to... I'm trying to think of the right words for it. But in solving the problem, first of all, you take the effort to understand what it is in great depth and detail. Sometimes there's more than one issue involved in the problem, so technically that's more than one problem. And you have to solve everything in order to move forward and progress. Whereas taking a small amount of action itself can change the nature of a problem. It looks a bit different and you give yourself a pat on the back for making progress, whereas really, you know, you're no further forward and you might even have moved backward in a sense.
Yeah. And it sounds like, you know, that you're very clear about when you implement problem-solving skills and you have a range of skills and attitudes and attributes which enable you to find appropriate solutions, that it will help, it will generalize and help you deal with any problems that may arise quicker and more effectively. And I like that because very often people think about a problem-solving mindset as only relative to immediate thing right in front of their face, and they don't recognize that having this mindset can be applicable in any area of life around any challenge.
Absolutely. Problem-solving is context-neutral. It's not about a particular type of situation or a particular area of your life. Anywhere you start solving problems and learn to look at problems objectively, to study them in detail, to identify what is the core of the issue and resolve it, that same set of skills is transferable to any area of your life. And I think it's not just with problem solving. I think as human beings, we tend to compartmentalize our skills. You know, for example, if we go into a job interview, and we're asked, have you ever done something that demonstrates your ability to use skill X? We just think of our work. We don't ever think of, well, has it been a personal situation where I use that skill? Have I a hobby or do I volunteer? You know, any other area of life where I might have used that skill that I can demonstrate it. We do tend to compartmentalize as human beings, and we don't realize that our skills can be transferred to just about any area.
Okay, so that's a critical thing to enlarge the frame and recognize that skills can be applicable anywhere, and that skill sets are applicable in a number of different contexts. That it's not relative to just one little thing right in front of our nose. Now, I'm wondering if we could dive right in and get into what your thoughts are about the 7 critical tools or aspects of a problem-solving mindset, what you would consider the big 7.
Well, we'll go through them one by one, I suppose, and we'll start off with the very first thing is responsibility. You know, things will go wrong, and when they do go wrong, you can either bury your head in the sand and pretend it's not happening, you know, or you can puff the chest out and say, okay, something's gone wrong, I'm going to find out what it is, and I'm going to deal with it. And it's like, kind of to illustrate it, there's a wonderful old story I love, and I've told it in so many contexts over the years, but it's by the Arab mystic Saadi, and I first encountered it in a book I have here called The Song of the Bird by Anthony de Mello. And it's called The Disabled Fox, and it's about a man walking through the forest one day when he saw a fox. The fox had lost his leg, and he was wondering how the fox survived. And after a while, he noticed that there was a tiger who would come along, and when the tiger had caught some prey and was feeding, whatever he would have left over, he would drop off in front of the fox, and the fox could feed off it. So the man thought he had nothing better to do other than he now had the easy solution for life. He was just going to lie there like he was the disabled fox. someone would come along and feed him. After a while, as he was close to starvation, he realized that that wasn't going to happen. And suddenly he heard a voice, and the voice said, "O you who are in the path of error, open your eyes to the truth. Follow the example of the tiger and stop imitating the disabled fox." And what we fail to see sometimes is other people, maybe they get helped out in situations where they're incapable of helping themselves. And we tend to think that we can sit back and everything will sort itself out. But really, the situation we should be taking there is we should be like the tiger saying, okay, how can I help myself be stronger? And when I help myself be stronger, how can I transfer that to help others? And that's a taking responsibility for your own situation. You know, it's getting yourself first, right, okay, there's a problem here. I am going to solve this problem. I am going to stand up. Even if you're in a group that's affected by the situation, all it takes is one person to stand up and say, okay, I'm going to find a solution to this problem. Yeah. I will take charge of the situation. And soon you find others willing to help. You know, sitting back and hoping that something is going to happen in your favor, avoiding dealing with it, it's not a problem-solving solution. It just doesn't work. So the first step in any problem-solving mindset is, you know, it's be like the tiger in that situation. Stand up, puff the chest out, and say, I am going to be the one who takes charge here. And
Move out of a passive stance, which I see so often in my work as a psychotherapist, people who have what we call learned helplessness, where they're essentially the disabled fox, or they have become very adept at getting other people to take care of them or do their work for them, and it's fine, fine in quotes, as long as that's predictable, but it doesn't do anything for their self-esteem or their personal sense of agency. And, you know, it sounds like what you're saying is you would have to move out of a passive stance, hoping and waiting for somebody else to take charge, and recognize that you need to steer your own ship.
Exactly. I mean, you can look at the example of, if you look at that situation like the disabled fox was lucky that somebody else chose to take care of him.
Yes.
But that's not a guarantee. You can't guarantee it. That is a form of learned helplessness. And sometimes you will get away with it and sometimes you won't. But it is moving out of that passive situation and saying, I am going to take charge here. I will steer the ship. And as you start to solve problems and you start to move forward, you find that your ability to deal with situations, your own resilience grows, your ability to not just cope. Of course, when a problem strikes, your first thing is to cope, you know, to make sure you're okay. But then you have the resilience to know that you can move forward and deal with the situation.
So you develop more confidence and more self-trust, and it sounds like the self-trust becomes the thing that propels you forward in more problem-solving.
Exactly. It's a spiral either way. If you go with the, I'm going to take responsibility, build that self-trust and build that, you know, ability to solve problems, you get better and better as you go along. But it's also a spiral with the learned helplessness. If you sit back and do nothing, you become more and more and more dependent on somebody else coming along to deal with your problems for you. You know, and eventually you're just going to run out of luck.
Yes. Now, you had in your blog post about this, or in your article, you talked about how when you see a problem in terms of responsibility, you're eager and willing to step up and attempt to resolve the situation. I know a lot of people who take a lot of responsibility. They're not passive. They're very active, and they take initiative. Even though they're not eager and willing, they may dread dealing with something because it's foreign or it just feels nasty or just complicated, but they don't let their feelings about it get in the way. So are you being literal when you say you're eager and willing to step up and attempt to resolve the situation, or do you just mean you take initiative despite any misgivings you may have about it?
Yeah, I think it's important to know that we can feel, in a sense, you can feel two things at the one time. Just because you're keen to solve a problem and you're going to say, right, you believe in your own ability to take it on, and you're like, okay, it has to be done, let's get it done. That doesn't mean you're not afraid of it going wrong. you know, are afraid of making a mistake or afraid of what's happening to you. If you take the example, to use a rather extreme example of it, if you look at Elon Musk at the moment, Elon Musk has taken on as a problem or a challenge, whichever way you want to look at it, getting people into space. I'm sure it's crossed Elon Musk's mind on more than one occasion the things that can go wrong with trying that. But he still steps up to deal, you know, he's still eager to take on that challenge and deal with it. You can be, I suppose, where I would use eager a lot of cases in the sense of problem solving is you know it has to be dealt with. So you're not going to put it off. You're saying, okay, well, if I have to do it, I'm going to take this on now and I'm going to deal with it. You're committed to taking on the challenge that's in front of you. You're not saying, when I say you're eager and you're willing to take it on, that doesn't mean that you don't think that it's a problem and that you're not worried about it. Of course you can be, but you realize that sitting there and worrying about it is not going to do you any favors.
Exactly.
The problem is not going to go away. So from that point of view, it is, again, it's that case of puffing the chest out and say, okay, let's get into this.
Yeah. All right, so it's really taking the bull by the horns and digging into it and not procrastinating, putting it off, or assigning it to somebody else or waiting passively for somebody else to solve it for you. Now, you also talk about emotional intelligence, and I'm wondering if you can say something about how you see emotional intelligence as one of the seven critical aspects of a problem-solving mindset.
Yeah, I mean, when a problem arises and something goes wrong, it's easy for us to get carried away with it, over-exaggerate, fly off the handle, think that it's the end of the world, you know, the whole all-or-nothing syndrome. This has gone wrong, so everything in my life must be wrong. You know, it's easy to get carried away with things. And it's about getting a grip on yourself to get back into that situation and deal with it. And I think a wonderful example, it's a great book I love, and I would recommend that people take a read of it. And it's called The Chimp Paradox by Dr. Steve Peters. And Dr. Steve Peters is a psychiatrist, and what he's quite famous on this side of the world for is he worked with the British cycling team, who've been incredibly successful over the last 15, 20 years. And he worked with the Sky professional cycling team, who also have been incredibly successful. And something he gives, which I think kind of describes the role of emotional intelligence in problem solving, is he uses an acronym called NEAT, N-E-A-T. And the N is for normal. And it's normal that we will get a bit emotional at times, or we might fly off the handle, or we don't deal with a situation as well as we would like to have dealt with it. So the E is to expect that is going to happen every now and again.
Mm-hmm.
The A is to accept that it has happened. This is what happened. I lost control. I made a mistake. I did something wrong. And then the T is to take care of the situation. So to resolve, you know, to resolve whatever has happened and get back in control. So, for example, one resolution might be to apologize to somebody.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if I give you an example of something that happened recently with me where I'd have to say I forgot the NEAT acronym. I think I dealt with it a bit wrongly. And I'd like to give an example where I made mistakes, because I'm not one of those people who wants to pretend he's perfect, because I'm not, and I do make mistakes myself. And I received an email recently. I was on, of an internet marketer, I was on her email list. And I received an email on International Women's Day, where one of her team had sent it. They said it was International Women's Day, and they offered a discount on one of her services in honor of International Women's Day, which I thought was a nice touch.
Mm-hmm.
But the next day, she sent another email, and she was telling us that a large number of people unsubscribed from her email list. In other words, they opted out of receiving her emails. And she said the reason it was because International Women's Day had been mentioned, and that she had lost 64 bigots from her list. Now, I don't know what you think, but I think the word bigots is an incredibly strong word to use.
Yeah.
And it can be quite emotive. And I thought, you're getting a bit carried away with the use of that. You know, I think you're anybody reading that is thinking, oh, my God, if I had have just opted out of your list yesterday, would that make me a bigot too?
Yeah.
And it's not something anyone wanted. So I said, I'm in the industry myself, so I'd like to, if I got carried away, I'd like somebody to let me know, listen, I think you went a bit overboard there. So I sent an email to the lady, pointing it out, saying, I think you went overboard with that. You shouldn't have, you haven't provided any evidence that these people are all bigots. To which I got a reply back, well, some of them told me that was the reason. So I replied back again with, now you're tarring everybody with the same brush, some is not all, and so on. But it went on for a few emails, and it was a bit narky at the end, and I said, right, I'm leaving this, I'm not getting involved in that conversation. But what I realized, and I think it's under where emotional intelligence can come in problem solving, is you recognize that, so not just managing your own emotions, but you recognize that somebody else is, as they say in poker, off tilt.
Mm-hmm.
Their emotions are running them. They're not being their normal selves. And you expect, if you expect that from them, I would have realized straight away that, hold on here, this woman's calling people bigots. She's obviously quite emotional at the moment. Now is not the day to email her to get on to her about this.
Right. Yeah.
You know, and that's where I felt I made a mistake. I would have been better off, because she's a woman whose work I always loved. So it's not a personal issue. And I feel I would have been better had I waited a few days. You thought about it and thought, okay, she's quite emotional. Let her calm down for a few days and just send a polite email. Instead,
so you're saying it's really important to not only recognize what something creates for oneself emotionally, but to be measured enough so that you're looking at what may be going on for the other person, and to not be reactive. It sounds like to not base any solutions or fixes on any immediate strong emotions. And you talk about centering yourself, which I think is really important.
Yes.
You know, I deal with a lot of that, the neuroscience of triggering and, you know, calming down the amygdala and all that. But it sounds like it's reactivity is the worst thing. And knowing what your triggers are is part of emotional intelligence.
Yes, and knowing what your triggers are, and knowing, but also identifying things that are likely to be triggers in others. Like,
yes.
As you and I can both recognize, and I'm sure anybody that's listening can recognize, the word bigots, it's an incredibly emotive word.
Yes.
Now, if somebody's using that, the likelihood is they're currently in a very emotional state. You know, it's not a guarantee that they are, but it's a tread with care warning if you're going to tread at all.
Yes, yes.
And I have to feel, while I noticed the word, I didn't think, well, what kind of state does that mean the other person may be in?
Okay, so you're really assessing receptivity as you are measured, and as you're careful and thinking about what may be going on for the other person, you're also making a judgment about their receptivity to this or that, the timing, how you say something, when you say something.
Exactly, and if you notice that the situation is becoming emotionally charged, like a lot of our communication is face-to-face, it's a lot easier to see if somebody's getting angry. And it's a point then where you say, well, can I de-escalate this situation? Can I calm both myself and the other party down to where we can get to talking about the facts? If you don't feel you can do it at that time there's nothing wrong with saying something along the lines of, okay, listen, I'm feeling a bit emotional now. I feel you maybe too. How about we park this, give ourselves a little time to come back, you know, to calm down, and we can come back and revisit it.
I encourage couples to use that tactic all the time. Not to use the tactic all the time, but I routinely encourage couples to use that tactic to recognize, you know, when to recognize your own escalation or when something's feeling very charged, and to notice if it seems to be happening for a partner as well, and to give yourself permission to call a timeout, to recognize unless we get hit by a truck, we can get back to it later, and we'll likely deal with it in a much more effective way if we catch our breath first.
Exactly, and if one of you does get hit by a truck, you're probably going to realize the situation wasn't that important. The hit by the truck is probably far more important, you know?
That's true.
It's kind of... it's getting that realization, and it's thinking sometimes. And I'll use and again use an example of how I feel I got that situation I described a little bit wrong. As soon as I felt a bit emotional about the use of the word bigots, I should have thought, what kind of emotion would you have to feel to be using that?
To be using it. Okay, so it's also using empathic skills. It's trying to tune in what may be happening with the other person so that you can move to the best possible result.
It is, and it's been open. And I mean, even if you're having doubts, it's having enough awareness of yourself and of the situation to inquire as to how they're feeling before you jump in with 2 feet.
Right. Yes. Okay. So it's being careful, and it's not letting strong emotions drive the process. Recognizing you're going to have them, but not letting them be the driver. And you know, you talked about centering yourself, regaining composure prior to choosing your response to the situation. I think that's really critical, and too many people do not do that. They make the most impulsive, they grab at the most immediate thing because it feels like it will be some kind of immediate fix.
Yeah, I did, like, something I learned myself, and as a youngster, I would have had a lot of issues with my emotions, and I found that just walking away at times is best. And at first, I had to explain to other people what I was doing. My mother, God bless her, she used to, I'd walk away when I'd be angry with her off or something, and she'd walk right behind me. And I had to wait till we were both calmed down when I said, listen, when I'm walking away, it's because I want to calm down. Let me go for a while.
Yeah.
I come back and talk. And it's amazing how much better a relationship we had once we both had an understanding. Once I'd chosen the right response of, I need to go and calm down, and once she understood that I was calming down and that I was going to come back, she could let me calm down.
Yes, yes, yeah.
And it's amazing. A lot of the rows with just that little bit alone just started to disappear. We had what were, I suppose, for many people, regular kind of, while I was a teenager, teenage rows with your parents. But once that bit was understood, the difference it made was phenomenal.
Oh, I'm sure. I'm sure. A respect for your process, definitely.
Yes.
Now, you also talk about goal identification, and I'm wondering if you could say more about that as one of the seven aspects of a problem-solving mindset.
Sure. We mentioned earlier about actually solving the problem, you know, as opposed to kind of reframing it. And it's, how do you know if you've solved the problem unless you know what the solution is? What is the end goal? So before you, especially with the more complex situations, like with some, obviously with some problems, it can be quite obvious what your end goal is. But for the more complicated ones, it's worth taking a little time before diving into trying to solve the problem. Sit down, take a little bit of time, and think, what am I trying to achieve here? Because if you don't, as I say, if you don't actually know what you're trying to achieve, you've two things that could happen here. You could solve the problem and not realize you've solved it.
Mm-hmm.
Or you could think you've solved the problem and not actually have solved it. So the only way you can ever know that you have solved the problem is know what is the actual goal. Now, if there's more than one person involved, it can be worth sitting down, you know, developing some ground rules first, depending on the situation. What are we looking for here as an end result? And I think it's much easier to solve a problem, you know, when you know what you're trying to achieve with it.
And do you encourage people to create a visual of that? What does the goal look and feel like so it comes alive for people, or is it more of a cognitive thing?
I think to an extent, some of that might require you to do what works for you. I had a boss in New Zealand years ago. I worked in training and development in New Zealand. And my boss there, everything was visual for him. If you wanted to convince him of anything, he had to be able to see it.
Mm-hmm.
So either you had to use very good imagery in your language, whereby you're painting the picture for while you're talking to him, or you get a physical picture. You know, whether you have to draw it or print it out off the internet, whatever, you have to get the physical picture put in front of him. But if he couldn't see it, you were pointless. Auditory, he struggled with. You know, the kinesthetic meant nothing to him at all, really. It's just, he was a really, really visually orientated person.
Right.
You know, you could save a hell of a lot of time by getting an image there. And for some people, if you're one of those kind of people, then I would say an image is very, very important. Myself, I'm more kinesthetic. You know, I'm more feeling orientated.
Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of, with a lot of the solutions I'm looking for, I identify first what it is as a feeling, and then if I need to describe it to somebody who's not so feeling-oriented as I am, I then, once I understand what it is to me, I then have to either put it in words or images. But
okay.
I would say whatever works for you to get it clear in your own mind what you're trying to achieve.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that I found very helpful in my work, I will ask people, you know, when they will identify a goal. I work with couples primarily, and they come in with very, very specific goals. And one of the questions I ask them is how will we know when, you know, people will talk in very vague kind of terms, like our communication will be better, we'll trust each other more, we'll feel more joy. And I will encourage people to get more explicit about that. How will that play out? Can you give me some examples of how that will manifest itself? But the even more helpful thing that I have found that I encourage people to do is to, and this is in subsequent sessions, I'll ask this question, how will we know when we're on the right road? What will you notice in the way of changes that will tell you I'm moving in the right direction. My actions are lined up with my goals. And I'm wondering, do you encourage people to sort of notice the progress like that, or would you say?
I like to use the question, how, you know, and you can work back from there. Then is, how will you know you've achieved your goal?
Yes.
And then put it in greater detail. And even for people like myself who use feelings, sometimes we struggle to put it in a straight of, well, the colour in the corner of the TV will be blue. I now have no idea what that actually means, but you know what I mean. That's something you can actually see. It is blue or it isn't blue. But from a feeling perspective, if I like to say, well, I'm going to feel happier right now, I'm not. Well, on a scale of 1 to 10, how happy would you say you feel right now?
Yeah.
And somebody might say, well, I'm feeling a 3. Okay, well, if you were to achieve this goal and solve this problem on a scale of 1 to 10, how happy would you expect to feel? And then you get another number out of them, and it might be 8. And you encourage to review, to record your feelings every day at the same time so that, you know, comparisons are equal and or as equal as can be. And then you track progress that way. Now, as you talk to people over subsequent sessions, you start to be able to relate to, well, this is what a 3 would look like. You know, as they think more and more about it. The first time you ask somebody, what would a 3 look like physically, for example, you define it very hard. But the more they're thinking every day, am I at 3 on the scale, am I at 4, am I at 5, the more they have to think that. They're more, you know, they become better able at explaining and clarifying what the physical situation would look like, or something that at least is observable.
Yeah, so gauging it, really tracking it with an identifiable marker, a number, but then, you know, what does that number correspond to each day so people can track, oh, I was at a 3 maybe last month, I'm at a 4. I'm at a 4 this month, so they can see progress and aligning it with a goal. It sounds like, and one of the things that I got from your article is that, obviously you're feeling that it's very important to understand the true nature of the problem, to really analyze the problem before rushing in to solve it. And wondering if you could say something about that.
Well, it's a bit like if we take the medical term, you know, the medical idea of, are you dealing with the symptom or are you dealing with the disease?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it's probably the best way to explain this. There's a number of illnesses over the years which people think there's something else because something else shows up. The one we were always taught, and if I say anything factually incorrect in this, I do apologize, but this is the way we were taught growing up, is that if you think of the AIDS virus, we were always told nobody dies of AIDS. Is that AIDS brings the immune system down so far that something else actually strikes the final blow.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's the way we were taught it. So from the point of view of, it's not, you might say, so in that case, let's say it was a common cold that came along in the end and that was the last illness that somebody suffered that ended up taking their life. The common cold wasn't the actual problem.
Okay.
I know that's a bit of an awkward analogy to use.
It's good. I like it. What are the symptoms of the problem? What are the, you know, but, you know, versus what do the symptoms point to, the larger issue that's the problem? Because people often get caught in the weeds with the symptoms.
Yeah, well, if you look at the example I've just given there, the cold would not have killed the person if there wasn't already a problem with their immune system.
Exactly.
So that's why, and that's why all the drugs that thankfully have been created or discovered, whatever the appropriate word is, to help people manage that terrible illness over the last 20 or 30 years, that has resolved the problem. Well, not necessarily not resolved sounds a bit much, but it's helped people to live with
yeah.
the illness. And they're not as susceptible to other illnesses, like cold. A cold is not as damaging as it used to be to somebody with the illness.
Yeah, I like the analogy. I like it.
It's an awkward analogy to pick because I'll be quite honest. I'm trying to watch my language to not be disrespectful to anyone. You know, I'm trying to. It can be anything with health can be emotional. So, it is. It's the best analogy I can use for that. In that you have to deal with the actual problem. If the doctors had spent years trying to deal with the cold, they would have achieved nothing. You know, instead they realized that there was an illness there attacking the immune system, and that's the illness they needed to deal with. And now,
yeah.
You know, it's not that long ago that if somebody got that diagnosis, we expected them to be no longer with us in 5 to 10 years. That's no longer the case.
So a systemic frame sounds like it's really important to look at the larger frame and the systemic frame rather than one little aspect of it or a symptom. You know, the true nature of the problem, the larger issue, and this reminds me of my friend and colleague who was always, you know, she was dealing with little aspects of it, little manifestations of the problem, but not the underlying issues that drove it all. So she was coping, but she never really solved anything. Now, Cartage, in the interest of time, you know, we could spend another hour on that one alone, but I want to get to the other few aspects. You also talk about a descriptive and objective detail as something to pay attention to in developing a problem-solving mindset. And you talk about the language of blame. Can you say more about that?
Yeah, it's very easy to get into. We don't like to think that we're in the wrong. And it's kind of, if I touch back on the NEAT acronym from earlier, it's very good if we can accept that it's normal that every now and again we're going to make mistakes, we're going to get things wrong. Because once we accept that, we're not as keen to blame others. We're willing to say, okay, well, maybe I made a mistake. Maybe I did something a little wrong here. Because when we come in with the language of blame and we say, you're at fault, it was you, it was this, the only response people have is to go on the defensive. So now they put up a wall and a barrier to you. So it's hard to have proper, reasonable, honest and open communication if the other person feels like you're attacking them. And it's hard to convince anyone that you are genuinely trying to solve a problem if you're making it personal and attacking the other person. we can always assume that in the vast majority of cases, if somebody makes a mistake, it wasn't deliberate. You're far better off to identify what went wrong, you know, how it happened, why it happened, what can you do to resolve the situation. And that's a much, you know, it's a much better way. I think of the constructive feedback model. So rather than attacking somebody, you know, if somebody's made a mistake, you know, or something has gone wrong on their watch, shall we say, the first thing to do is to identify what the issue is. Get as much detail about it as possible, you know, as in, you know, what went wrong, how it happened, what damage was done, if any. Then why it's important. You discuss why it's important to get it right, you know, to rectify any mistakes and get it right. And then together, you sit down and you come up with what is the best way to move forward from here to ensure it doesn't occur again. Now, if you had somebody, if you make a mistake and somebody talks to you that way, let's say you had a row with your husband or something went wrong, if your husband came to you with that approach, wouldn't it be far better and far more likely to come out with a positive outcome than if your husband came out and said, oh, for God's sake, Susan, I can't believe you did this again and went on a 20-minute rant?
Blame is relationships. It's absolutely toxic. And all we have to do is look to American politics right now. I'm sure you guys are having a horror show or a laugh. Just look at American politics as an example of horrendous problem solving at this point. Everybody blaming everybody.
I can assure you it's not a whole lot better over here.
Yeah, well, that's too bad. I thought, you know, it feels like it's the worst anywhere here. But it's a perfect example of what not to do, because people just go on the defensive and offensive, and it creates an endless loop of reactivity and bad feelings, and nothing gets solved. Okay, so you also talk there in that one about not filling in the gaps with assumptions, you know, to really not move with presumptions or assumptions, but, you know, to ask questions and, you know, invent as you're in problem-solving mode, especially when you're doing it collaboratively with other people.
Well, it's the one area that proves we naturally are problem solvers and we naturally want to be, is that the reason we make assumptions is because there's gaps in the information. So we try to solve the problem by filling in the gap.
Yes.
But to do that, we put our own interpretations, and it's not something that's based on fact. So, it's far better to use questions. If you don't understand something or doesn't make sense, ask. Now, it may turn out that the answer is what you thought it was, but it may turn out to be something completely different, which changes the whole context of the situation.
I talk with people all the time about curiosity as their best friend, that rather than projection, moving with your assumptions about what the other person wants and needs or about what's best for a solution, curiosity is really your best friend. And to be seeing curiosity and asking as a very positive, you know?
Yes, and it's like, it's and that kind of switches back on the goal identification idea of, rather than assuming, it's why you clarify what the goal is, and especially if there's more than one person, because that other person mightn't want the same thing you want. Like,
mm-hmm.
I'm sure you're like me, you probably often turn down clients because what they need or what they want doesn't fit with the area you like to, you work on, or the area you feel you're specialized in. And you realize mm-hmm. that the best service you can do is to inform them that you're not the best person for the job, or to direct them elsewhere.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and that's giving them the ultimate service. But you can only do that because you take the time to work out, you know, to ask them what their goal is.
Right. Well, we're getting into, and we're running out of time, but we're getting into one of the other ones, which is probing and reflecting. Questions and reflections to gather as much information about the problem as possible, so that you're not moving with assumptions or misassumptions.
I think we took... Sorry, go ahead there.
You have an interesting frame on active listening. You know, you're asking questions and you're listening, And you talked about how you don't necessarily encourage people to do the reflective listening where they're kind of mirroring back verbatim what the other person is saying, but just to listen. And if they're really listening and suspending their own reality, they will begin to naturally do verbal and physical gestures that show that they're hearing.
Yeah, what I think is the first thing to do is to listen, because you can't actually reflect back accurately if you didn't listen in the first place. So I think we've just put things in the wrong way around. The whole idea of active listening, I think, got big in the 80s and 90s, and people started pretending they were listening. You know, maybe to hold a pencil in their hand and they move the pencil with every nod of your head and all that kind of thing. No, instead of actually thinking, my viewpoint would be, stop trying to communicate to the other person you're listening. Just listen. And when you're listening, that will communicate the fact that you're listening. People can notice you're listening. Also, you will then reflect at the right time. Reflection is a very useful tool. It's an outstanding tool, I think. But you reflect at the right time. Don't just repeat back what they said to you for the sake of repeating it back.
Right.
I just think, it's my opinion that a reflection should have value. You know, I think there's many problems, and I find it in my coaching the whole time. I regularly help people solve the problems by just reflecting back what they've said to me. You know, they're actually telling themselves the answer. They're just not listening to it.
Yes, yes. So,
you know, and when I reflect
in, taking it in and reflecting it back after you've processed it, after you've taken it in and heard it. And then the reflection is a true hearing. It's a true manifestation of hearing. It's not just parroting somebody else's words and going through the motions.
Yes, and I think that's the important thing. We got too keen on pretending, you know, on trying to give the image that we're doing something, and we get so keen on giving the image that we don't actually have the substance of doing it. And if you listen to somebody and then formulate your response, instead of one of the hardest things to do in communication, and I'm guilty of it myself as well, is that while the other person's talking, you're already thinking about what you're going to reply with.
Right. Formulating, that's a debate, that's not listening, right?
You know, instead of, if you think about it, how can you properly reply to it if you don't listen to it when they're saying it?
Right. I encourage people to suspend their own reality and to get into the other person's shoes, to really listen with their heart. What is the other person trying to say? Knowing that you'll have your turn, but right now this is not about your own experience. You suspend it. It'll be there when you need it, but right now it's about their experience, their perception, what they're wanting and needing.
Yes, I think that's put in a far better way than I put it, to be honest with you. That is absolutely quality way of saying it. You know, put yourself in their shoes, hear them out, try... If you actually try and experience what they're saying, it's a far better way of communicating, and a lot of people, when they first hear of that idea, probably think my conversations will go on forever. Actually, they'll be much quicker, because if you hear them the first time, they won't ever have to repeat it.
Yeah, and you won't have confusion and misunderstandings. Yes.
Exactly.
Now, in the interest of time, Cartage, The last thing you talked about was number 7, the desire to find the most appropriate solution. Could you very briefly describe that?
Well, it kind of builds on a bit, I suppose, from the goal, the idea of goal identification. You're not just trying to, it's not just about you trying to feel that you've solved the problem. So don't just jump at the first thing and go, oh yeah, that will solve it. Go, right, what is going to deal with this situation fully? Get the problem out, not just get the problem off my plate, but actually resolve it, make sure it's gone, dealt with properly, all parties involved are satisfied. You know, so review more than one solution. Think of more than one potential solution. Review them. Try and think of what impact they're likely to have. Again, if there's other people involved, try and put yourself in their shoes and view it from their situation.
Mm-hmm.
Don't be afraid to ask them. In fact, do ask them. You know, what they think would be the most appropriate solution. And take your time to work it out if need be. You know, so it's best, you know, it is far better to take a period of time to generate as many solutions as you can and work through them. And before you go, yes, this is the one that actually resolves the problem.
Well, to that point, I see so many couples in particular who start backwards. They start at the most immediate. They make a stab at a solution. We should do this or we should do that, rather than listening to each other's concerns and then generating possible solutions that would be inclusive of as many of those concerns as possible. Why don't we do this? Why don't we do that? Rather than listening to each other, asking questions, showing curiosity, and generating different solutions and taking time to do that. So, you know, I like what you're saying because it's very consistent with what it's not just problem solving, but it's in all relationships dealing with making decisions together. How you consider other people's needs and you move toward the best possible decision. Again, it sounds like you're saying you can evaluate each potential solution to determine which one is most likely to bring about the conclusion that you're seeking.
Yeah, and that's why I put it at the end of the list. You know, there's seven things we put in there, and it's why the solution comes at the end. It's almost, in a certain sense, it's almost like a funnel. You start with a wide mouth at the top. You know, you get as much information in there as possible. You talk to each other. You talk things out. You listen. You probe and you reflect. You try and identify what you're trying to achieve, you know, in dealing with this actual problem. And then as the funnel gets narrower, it's then that you're starting to focus on what is the ultimate solution to this. But before you get to that narrow point, you have to put everything in. You have to deal with everything that's relevant to the situation.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, Cartage, I want to thank you. We're really out of time. I can't believe the time went so quickly. I would like to thank you so much for all your input and your wisdom and, I like the way you look at all of this from various points of view and you consider all the different issues. You are a prolific writer. I would encourage anybody listening to this podcast to go to Cartage's site, and that's coachingpositiveperformance.com, right?
That's correct, yes.
Okay. I have no idea where and how you find the time to do the amount of writing that you do and to deal with all the subjects that you do, but I was blown away, and I think anybody who goes to your site will share that feeling. And there's so much wisdom and in a very down-to-earth, very can-do kind of style. So I want to thank you, and thanks for coming on in the middle of the day. I don't know what time it is. What time it is it there in Ireland
point? It's approaching 7 p.m.
Oh, 7 p.m. Okay, so you're near the end of your day. You can put your feet up. Maybe at some point in the future we can do another show about one of the other tons of topics that you deal with, because I relate to so many of them. But thank you again, and thanks to our listeners. So Cartage, I really do appreciate it.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay, take care. And again, you can find Cartage on his website at coachingpositiveperformance.com. Okay. My next episode will be on Wednesday, April 12th at the usual 8:30 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. And I'll soon be announcing the topic and possible guest. So long, and have a good day and have a good weekend. Stay safe, stay warm. Take care. Bye-bye.